are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, March 7th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, two guests, a doubleheader. Juan Cole, professor, academic, legend in Middle Eastern studies, author of Muhammad, Prophet of Peace. We're talking about the state of the Israeli elections, the Netanyahu indictment, the smears against Ilhan Omar and the pushback. And then the great Megan Day, Jacobin Magazine. She was at the Bernie launch. We're talking about Bernie Sanders, 2020, and class warfare. That's what it is.
Pew, 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 pew.
Exactly. Democrats put off their smear Ilhan Omar resolution because of grassroots pushback. Although Rahm Emanuel has opened his mouth to slander her, and I would just like to take this time to remind everybody that Rahm Emanuel helped cover up the murder of a child by a Chicago PD officer who's now in jail. So, look, Rahm can say what he likes, and I can too, and that will be the only thing I say about Rahm Emanuel. Bernie Sanders comes to the unequivocal defense of Ilhan Omar and open discourse. Elizabeth Warren, far more vague. And Kamala Harris, somewhere in the middle. Better than Warren, not as good as Bernie. Teenager killed by Israeli sniper in Gaza as investigations move forward on crimes committed against Gazan protesters. The Democratic National Committee rejects Fox News for debate, citing the New Yorker article, which I guess is just formalizing what we already know, which is that Fox is functionally a state propaganda network.
It's actually an insult to state propaganda networks.
It is. I have to say, as someone who studied in Turkey, state propaganda looks a lot cooler there. Trump just made sure you won't hear about how many civilians are killed in drone strikes. They're even higher than under the Obama era. And in a blow to conservatives, a national business group is staying out of a Wisconsin Supreme Court race. And Senator McSally, former Air Force pilot, says a superior officer raped her in her time in the Air Force. The U.S. government contradicts Homeland Security Secretary Bridget Nielsen, admits that 471 migrant parents have faced deportations. And the Congressman Ro Khanna suggests the Democratic Party should oppose all large-scale sanctions against Venezuela. And over 30 congresspeople finally signed a letter decrying Jair Bolsonaro's assault on rights in Brazil, and note that Lula, the most important politician of the country, was barred from running in what they call questionable circumstances. We're going to get to that in a second. But first, Donald Trump has really been on a pretty steady comedic decline since being elected president. The only thing he's really good at in life is inheriting money and dunking on Republicans and being a, you know, a messy bastard.
Work in the press.
Work in the press. But, I mean, look, I guess if you want, I mean, some people might get sensitive to this because this is definitely a guy's just brain in pure decline here. But this was funny from yesterday. This is Donald Trump with Tim Cook. Tim Cook was at a table with Bolsonaro a couple of weeks ago in Davos. So the Apple CEO, very comfortable consorting with fascists. Here he is meeting with the clown fascist in chief, Donald Trump.
I used to say, Tim, you got to start doing it over here. And you really have. I mean, you've really put a big investment in our country. We appreciate it very much, Tim Apple. But we're...
That's also not true. Of course, Apple still is hiding a massive amount of assets in overseas tax shelters and using sweatshop labor in their hardware and manufacturing. But let's just play that one more time.
Put a big investment in our country. We appreciate it very much, Tim Apple. But
Jeff Amazon sent naked pictures of himself. It was sad.
Bill Windows. I don't really like that guy.
Bill Windows, great guy.
I want that to be purposeful shade. It's probably not, though.
No, that's way.
That's the milk people are in my brain.
If you can abstract away from all the bad outcomes, Trump is without question the funniest president we've ever had.
Oh, yeah. Obama never did so. Obama's just like, yeah, Tim Apple's here, whatever.
I think JFK or Lincoln are also very funny.
JFK could do, JFK actually would do the like, Tim Apple's here.
JFK,
like he would do the shade.
JFK was talking to Eisenhower during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Eisenhower says, like, I don't think that'll make them shoot him off. And they talk about nuclear missiles.
Jesus.
And JFK's like, oh, God.
Yeah. Oh, God. No, well. JFK, I don't want to get into the whole JFK debate, but one thing that you just cannot deny is that the man had very well-developed sense of irony. There's in that speech at American University, which is, you know, who knows? Maybe he would have followed up a policy. We don't know because he was assassinated. But where he gave, like, the basically a call for, like, really de-escalating the Cold War and pointing towards disarmament and talking about how, like, 70% of our body is water and we all share that same water and the ocean. I mean, it is a great speech taken in its own terms. And the thing, though, it's funny in the beginning, it's a funny piece of historical kind of trivia, but Robert Byrd is there, the senator who died, you know, only a couple years ago, and he's already a senator. And Robert Byrd, another extremely complicated figure, and in many ways a bad figure, but in other ways a very admirable figure, who did apologize forthrightly for his badness. But at any rate, he was a poor guy from West Virginia, so he was getting his degree at night school from American University. And Kennedy said, like, I have a former colleague who's here, who's receiving his degree after working nights for several years. I'll be getting the same degree in 2 hours. It was just like the type of joke that you would do today. It was very interesting because you see, like, we talk about how comedy dates itself quickly, and JFK's like the president and his like sense of irony and sensibility. It's like you look at Reagan and there is something like, what was going on in the 80s that people thought this was so amazing? And then you look back at Kennedy and you're like, yeah, it makes sense.
Relative to previous presidents.
Yeah. Just on a cultural level.
I also like the stories about LBJ's hog.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. LBJ's hilarious in entirely different ways.
In entirely different ways. And, I mean, my God, I'm erasing a lot of history here, but, you know, if not for Vietnam, the guy would be looked on pretty fondly. I think there's something about, like, there hasn't been, like, an SOB who was, like, occasionally on the right side in, like, quite some time. Like, a guy, like, just, like, stories of him, like, terrorizing segregationist senators. There's something, like, very satisfying about that.
The image of the hamburgers will live in our minds forever.
Yeah, that's Trump, right? Gave us hamburgers.
Never forget.
Which I think we undercovered on this show.
Yeah, we did undercover on this show.
No, maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not. So let's start actually with this. We're going to get to the other clown fascist who completely humiliated himself, J.R. Bolsonaro, in the fun half, because he tweeted something out about Carnival. We'll bridge this segment together. We'll get to Carnival in a second. This is really important. And I will say in generalities that people, particularly with TMBS, but obviously also this show, we're part of the context of helping make this letter happen, is how I'll put it. And about 30 members of Congress, spearheaded by Congresswoman Susan Wild, who's a really good labor-oriented congresswoman out of Pennsylvania, and also co-led by Ro Khanna, and maybe let's just, you know, run down some of the other names on the list. Of course, Ilhan Omar is there, Jamie Raskin, Bobby Rush, Adriano Espaillat, Ro Khanna was the other lead on it, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Deb Haaland, Jose Serrano, Frank Pallone Jr., but also Charlie Crist, as an example, Mark Pocan, James McGovern, Alan Lowenthal, and others. I wanted to, so these are people you should look at the letter and make sure that you thank them. And they have signed a letter written to Mike Pompeo. And again, this is the type of thing that will register in Brazil. It's going to make no difference, obviously, to current U.S. policy, but this is a big deal in Brazil. And I'll read just briefly, I'll read the first two graphs, and then it goes into detail on the abuse of the LGBTQ community under Bolsonaro, the assault on indigenous people, as well as the assault on labor and pensions. Dear Secretary Pompeo, we're writing to urge you to publicly emphasize the importance of defending the human rights of the people of Brazil. Since the election of far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro as president, we have been particularly alarmed by Bolsonaro's threat poses to the LGBTQ community and other minority communities, women, labor activists, and other political dissidents in Brazil. We are deeply concerned that by targeting hard-won political and social rights, Bolsonaro is endangering Brazil's long-term democratic future. As a still-developing democracy, Brazil must be particularly vigilant in protecting its institutions and ensuring the separations of power in the country. Even before Bolsonaro took office, the regressive trends pushing against Brazil's democracy were clear. It should concern all who are committed to Brazilian democracy that Bolsonaro was elected after former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, widely acknowledged as the most popular leader in Brazil, was barred from running in controversial circumstances that put to risk the right of the people of Brazil to truly, freely choose their president. Of course, the next letter must be stronger. Zero evidence, and he is in fact the world's most prominent political prisoner. And there's some new stories about that case. Again, zero material evidence, literally jailed for indeterminate acts. The second sentence he was just hit with, a forensic analysis showed that the judge copied and pasted part of the first sentence into the second sentence. And there's another story that might be coming out, I can't comment on yet, that will blow a whole other hole into Judge Sergio Moro's case. Carnival is a site of resistance in the Caribbean, and it was no different at this year's Brazilian Carnival, which is part of the freakout of the bizarre Brazilian president. This is a report from Michael Fox for the World News Network about resistance and Lula Livre at Brazil Carnival.
Brazilians are in the streets for Carnival, millions across the country. And for many of them, it's an act of resistance. Supporters of former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva have formed Free Lula Samba groups around the country, like this one in Florianópolis. They've been practicing for several weeks. They took to city streets over the weekend.
We are here today with everyone who wants to combat fascism in Brazil. This is a political act to combat Lula's unjust imprisonment and transforming Carnival into a big grassroots action against this.
Former President Lula has been in prison since last April. He was convicted of accepting a beachside apartment from a company seeking government contracts. But the ruling was based on plea bargain testimony. No evidence was ever found. His jailer, Judge Sergio Moro, is now President Jair Bolsonaro's justice minister. Lula supporters say his imprisonment was just a move to block him from running in last year's elections.
Today, the greatest grassroots leader that we've ever had is unjustly imprisoned, accused of crimes that he didn't commit and for which there is no proof. And we need to agitate so we can get him out of prison so he can be free.
They've also removed protection for the Amazon and indigenous people, which is an almost genocidal threat to those communities in Brazil and a threat to the entire global ecosystem, although leaders in Bolsonaro's new government have called things like global warming a cultural and Marxist plot. They also have an advisor who's a Brazilian who lives in the state of Virginia, who's a fascist that does astrology consults, who recently was actually asking on social media for money to help get health coverage. The ironies and disgustingness of these people abound. Lula lifted 40 million people out of poverty, and he and the Workers' Party helped transition Brazil out of a military dictatorship in the 1980s. So thank all of the Congress people, particularly Congresswoman Susan Wilde and Ro Khanna, but also AOC, Jamie Raskin, Jim McGovern, Adriano Espalat, Bobby Rush. I'll be tweeting this out again. and Premila Jayapal, Jesus Chewy Garcia, Peter Welch, and Jane Schakowsky, Rosa DeLauro, and several others. They need to be thanked, and they should be pushed to do further letters, maybe even a resolution in the House condemning the political imprisonment of Lula and the cancellation of democracy and rise of fascism in Brazil. And also, if your congressman didn't sign it, your congressperson didn't sign it, call them and ask them why not. All right, today's show, if I can find this. I know Sam usually loves to read these because it's the New Yorker. He gets all excited. The New Yorker is sponsoring my show. Do you see, Dad? The New Yorker represents the best writing in America today, both online and in print. The New Yorker covers a full range of topic, including politics, news, international affairs, climate change, popular culture, the arts, fiction, food, humor, and cartoons. Not to mention, the New Yorker touches on subjects that many people may not have previously put much thought into, like the world's diminishing supply of sand, paper jams, stink bugs, and hunting down heirloom tomatoes. Some of the New Yorker's incredible writers include contributors like Ronan Farrow, who's written breaking news stories on Harvey Weinstein, Les Moonves, and many a Brett Kavanaugh, along with Jane Mayer. The new Jane Mayer piece on just how specifically Fox News functions as a propaganda network. All incredible reporting. And Helen Rosner, a James Beard Award-winning food writer who contributes essays and reports stories on all things gastronomic. I keep up with The New Yorker. I read The New Yorker regularly. You're still going to get incredible deep dives. The piece that I did last year on this show on how the Tory PR firm Bell Pottinger worked with the Zuma government to create a fake populist campaign in the service of foreign direct investment and to distract from corruption scandals in South Africa is one of the great pieces, the one of the in-depth, deeply reported pieces that you expect from The New Yorker, along with really good columns and broad art coverage. I read every issue. And now our listeners can save 50% and get 12 weeks off The New Yorker for just $6 when you go to thenewyorker.com/majority and enter majority. You'll get an exclusive tote as well as unlimited access to The New Yorker app, online archive, crossword puzzle, and newyorker.com with between 10 and 15 exclusive site-only stories every day. That's newyorker.com/majority. Enter majority. We are going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Professor Juan Cole.
He was a man, and what did he know? Spent his time living in a casino. Never know. Couldn't get away, couldn't ever get it anyway. Couldn't ever level, cause he's living like a devil, hey.
Couldn't get away, couldn't ever get it anyway. Couldn't ever level, cause he's living like a devil.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks at the helm here. Joining us now is the legendary proprietor of the Informed Comment blog. He also teaches history at the University of Michigan and is the author most recently of Muhammad, Prophet of Peace, Professor Juan Cole. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Professor Cole, let's start with Israel. What's actually happening there? An election has been called. A prime minister, a sitting prime minister, has been indicted. A left-wing party has been banned from running, even as even further far-right extremist and overtly racist parties enter the political process. What's your kind of broad read on the electoral landscape of Israel right now?
Well, Israel, for the past couple of decades, has been trending not just right, but really far right in its politics. And, you know, in some ways, some of these trends are similar to what's happened in the United States. There's an enormous increase in inequality. A handful of billionaires really are running the show. It's getting hard for ordinary people to pay their rent in places like Tel Aviv. And then on top of everything else, you have a severe racial divide in Israel between Jewish Israelis and Palestinian Israelis. About, close to 25% of Israel is probably of Palestinian heritage. Often you see a statistic of 20%, but in any case, it's very significant. Their party, the party that tends to represent them, Balad, which has also Jewish Israeli supporters, as you say, is a far-left party. And it has just been banned from running by people like Avigdor Lieberman, the former Israeli defense minister, on the grounds that it's insufficiently loyal to Israel. That is to say that it's largely supported by the Palestinian Israelis. So this will be overturned by the Supreme Court. But the Palestinian Israelis really are increasingly checking out of the Israeli political elections, and this will probably also further hurt their turnout, which is what Lieberman wants. So it's a little bit like voter suppression in the United States, where laws are passed like ID laws and so forth to keep African Americans from voting. In Israel, the right has the luxury of just announcing it's not going to let their party run at all.
Now, some people who will defend the kind of resiliency of Israeli institutions, and look, I don't really see a contradiction between acknowledging sort of three things: that there's an occupation, there's a siege on Gaza. These are both unspeakable violations of every kind of principle that you would hold if you had even just kind of basic democratic and liberal values. Then there's the the growth of Israel as an extreme far right state in the last decade, even. And then there's the fact that there are still some mechanisms, certainly of democracy, that work, I guess, in some ways, and applied to specific things, robustly. So how do you kind of balance out that calculation in terms of how to read and understand exactly what Israel is as a state, embodying all of these contradictions?
Sure. Well, as you say, things are on a spectrum. Within Israel proper, there are regular elections, and however, there's increasing signs of them not being entirely on the up and up. So I would say that, Freedom House has those three categories of not free, partially free, and free. Israel is only partially free for many reasons. One is, again, these steps that are taken to limit the franchise of the Palestinian Israelis. But also within the Jewish Israeli majority, the corruption charges against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are not, in my view, just corruption. They're about the destruction of democracy. It's far beyond monetary corruption. He has charged of with, you know, taking gifts from rich people to do them favors, so, which is ordinary everyday corruption that happens everywhere. But in addition to that, the casino mogul Sheldon Adelson in the United States started a newspaper in Israel, which is a cheerleading instrument for Netanyahu himself, and gave it away for free. You could just get it on the street corner and just pick it up for free. And it's a full newspaper. It has a staff. It does reporting. And so it was competing with real newspapers that were founded just to do news and not just to support Netanyahu. And Netanyahu is accused of going to one of the real newspapers and saying, look, I know your business is being hurt by this free rag we're giving out. We can print more of it or we can print less of it. If you're nice to me, we'll print less of it. You know, Netanyahu is accused of shaping the reporting on him in the national press by blackmailing the newspapers with bankruptcy and using Sheldon Adelson's casinos as a piggy bank, essentially for his muscling of these newspapers. And there's more of that kind of blackmail and pressure put on these newspapers, you know, because the government is in charge of licensing and so forth. So, I mean, they're calling it corruption charges, but they're really dictator charges.
Yeah, so can you – that's right. That's really important, and I'd like you to actually compare and contrast. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was released from prison about a year ago on corruption charges. Olmert is a – I mean, certainly a much more charismatic and appealing personality than Netanyahu. He certainly presided over his own great crimes against Gaza and Lebanon as prime minister. But he also recognized rhetorically, and if you believe in a two-state solution framework, he certainly put on the table the most substantive offer of an actual two-state solution to the Palestinian leadership. And he suggests, I mean, one, he had a funny line that he felt bad for Netanyahu because of his delicate mental state, which was a funny sort of like he knows, he still knows how to throw a jab. But his claim is actually that the corruption charges that took him down, which were purely of the, you know, money in a shoebox to do a favor variety, were actually spearheaded by Sheldon Adelson and far-right forces in the United States because he was willing to buck the extreme right in Israel. So, I mean, maybe he's just justifying himself, but can you kind of compare and contrast the Olmert saga, where this guy actually did go to jail, and then the much larger stakes of what Netanyahu is accused of, and then Olmert's claim that he essentially was corruption charges were the engine to move him out of the picture because he wasn't appeasing not only the Israeli far right, but he actually really points the finger at the American far right, which is fascinating.
Oh, sure. Well, the American far right is extremely influential in Israel, and indeed, you know, now there's this big issue over AIPAC and its lobbying and giving campaign or directing campaign monies, directing other organizations to give campaign monies to American politicians to get them loyal to Israel. The fact is that AIPAC doesn't represent, you know, the American Jewish community. The American Jewish community leans left. 70% of them vote Democrat. The AIPAC is, you know, represents a handful of extremely wealthy, very far right wing Jews, and cooperates then with the right wing evangelicals to generate, you know, messages to Congress and to the media and so forth. So, you know, the fact that the mechanisms for the Israel lobbies are in the hands of a right-wing group in the United States is then has this enormous impact on Israel itself. I mean, I think that Olmert is just corrupt. I mean, he was taking money from, as you say, for favors, even going back apparently to when he was mayor of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And I think the Israeli Israeli police are some of the last uncorrupted institutions in Israel in this regard.
Right.
And they really are willing to indict a prime minister, which, you know, as you suggested, it shows that Israeli democracy is not completely gone. And the fact that the attorney general, who was appointed by Netanyahu, is willing to go forward with these charges against him is also a sign of the continued robustness of elements of Israeli democracy. But there are starting to be, as I said, these severe constraints on it between the manipulation of the press and of press licenses and the corruption and the disenfranchisement of large numbers of voters and then the ongoing occupation. I mean, this is a very complex situation, and just calling it a democracy would be a misnomer.
How does this play out in the sense that, you know, I mean, again, Olmert, I'll just, you know, referring to him, he quite confidently predicted that Netanyahu will lose the election. He said that, you know, parties from the center right through the left have been asking him for advice, which I guess is probably his stand-in for being sensible. But you could have a situation where it seems to me just as likely, if not more likely, that another even more extreme far-right coalition wins. Netanyahu's return to power with these dictatorial aspirations, and his response to these charges so far, in my read, has not been to deny them. I mean, he has denied them, but he's almost been asking for like them to be crushed in an extrajudicial sort of process. I mean, how do you see that dynamic playing out?
Right. Well, with regard to the upcoming election, the polling suggests that Netanyahu's right-wing coalition will get 61 seats, which is a bare majority, and that Likud will be the largest party in the coalition, and that would mean that Netanyahu gets another term as prime minister. 61 is a very slim margin in a parliament of 120. Whether the far right will get that many is of course impossible to actually predict. There's uncertainty about this. There is a strong center right tendency, which is offsetting the far right to some extent. But, you know, it's been pointed out by my colleague Mark Tesler that in the last few elections, a center right always emerges and does relatively well, but then withers on the vine after the election and doesn't quite get to a majority. There's kind of now, you know, some of these things are ethnic, but there's kind of a constituency for the far right of various sorts: the ultra orthodox, the Eastern European and Russian immigrants, the Mizrahim, or the Jews originally from the Middle East itself. Mm-hmm. All of them tend to relatively far-right politics. So it's hard for the center-right to win.
What is the center-right now? Is Labor considered center-right now? Are we talking about Yair Lapid's party? Like, what would be center-right now?
Yes, I'm calling Gantz and Yair Lapid as center-right. And I think it's... In Israel, they're called centrists, but I think they you know, in American terms, they would be center right, or in European ones.
Right.
Labor is on the left, but Labor is a shadow of its former self. It doesn't amount to much.
Right. And what about Meretz? That would be the only.
They're done. They're okay. Done. I met Shulamit Aloni years ago, and we got along fine. And I was joking with Israeli colleagues years later that if I were in Israel, since I like Shulamit, maybe I'd vote for Meretz. But these were Israeli lefties, so they called me a running dog capitalist and imperialist for that. But Meretz, which is center left, those parties really just aren't able to get significant representation.
That's important to underline, right? Because Moretz is by Americans, you know, I would deem, you know, labor to me is definitely in very much the center, as it were, and particularly with regards to things like the occupation. But Moretz, you know, could be fairly deemed, I agree with you, a center-left party. And in the current Israeli context, I mean, they might as well be communists who want to live in one state. I mean, that, you know, that's how far the pendulum has swung to the far right in Israel.
Yes. Oh, well, absolutely. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it depends on how you measure these things. If you're looking at issues in wealth distribution, which is traditionally the way you judge whether something is left or right, then labor is left.
Right.
You know,
right.
They support labor unions and things, but which Likud does not. But if you get outside of internal Israeli politics and look at issues of occupation, well, labor engineered the occupation, there's not that much difference between them and the right on that issue.
Ilhan Omar has been speaking out on this. So, what's your read on that?
Yeah. Well, before we move to that,
please.
We should just mention briefly that that one of the ways that Netanyahu hopes to get his 61 seats and a majority in the new parliament is that he's encouraged one of his coalition allies to bring on board a terrorist organization.
Yes.
You know, the Otzma Yehudit, the Jewish power faction of Kahanists, who, you know, various forms of Kahanism, going back to Rabbi Meir Kahana, have been termed terrorist by the U.S. State Department, by the Israeli government banned them from running for office. Some of their members celebrate the massacre at the Tomb of the Patriarchs in 1994 by Baruch Goldstein, who shot down 28 innocent civilians, a little bit the way that the Trump machine has, you know, authorized support by the white supremacists in order to get a margin over the Democrats. So Netanyahu has authorized this coalition with the Kahanists. And one of their leaders who couldn't get into the United States for being considered a terrorist or a member of a terrorist organization has just been allowed to run by the Election Commission, which is controlled by the Likud, the ruling far-right wing party. So this is a very distressing development. You know, Israeli politics is far right, but these people are crazy, and even the American Israel lobbies are upset, and I think they're afraid that this is increasingly a hard sell to the American public.
Right, and this is the other. Actually, maybe we should put this on the table too. I mean, this is the thing that when leaders, again, like an Ehud Barak or an Ehud Olmert, would talk about the need to end. You know, they meant it in different ways, but some form of ending the occupation, having a two-state solution, they would couch it, and they used the word apartheid before anybody else. A lot of they would couch it in those terms. They would say, look, American Jews, by and large, are, you know, frankly, pretty liberal. They care about things like civil rights, and this just isn't tenable. But the new Israeli leadership has clearly made the calculation that, first of all, there's plenty. You know, there's an extreme far right that opposes civil rights in the United States. There's resurgent neo-fascists in Europe. And then there's governments that you can do business with that don't even have, you know, of course, in the United States case, it's obviously hypocritical and contradictory. But as an example, in China or Russia or something, there isn't even a kind of pretend human rights discourse. So you can just, you know, go about your business. And if the liberals don't like you anymore, then, you know, so be it, seems to be the calculation.
That's right. Well, I think the calculation is that wealthy far-right billionaires are the ones you need to please, and,
right.
and they don't care about things like occupation. In fact, they're looking for ways to profit from it.
Right. Right. And so that's how this, and so in the context, this emerges Ilhan Omar basically saying, and I think, look, I'll just stipulate, I've kind of removed the nuance in my analysis, because I think there are times and places for things. And I think that there was a time when maybe you could have a carefully calibrated conversation where calling her anti-Semitic or calling her into question for criticizing Israel is wrong, flat out wrong. It's a smear. It's dishonest. It's disgusting. And then you could say some of her language, particularly actually language that she used. The only one that's been identified to me was the hypnotize the world tweet from 2012. And I think, yes, that's legitimately ill-considered and just strategically don't do that. But we're at a point now where a sitting congresswoman has had a target put on her back in an act of political terrorism to keep her from speaking honestly and freely on the conduct of a sovereign nation state, in the same way, frankly, she has on many others. And it's exposed fault lines in the Democratic Party that it seems to me people like Nancy Pelosi are just not adroit enough to read, because, you know, there are those of us who are, you know, in that coalition who are younger, who not only don't want her to be in any way condemned or silenced, we find the whole exercise to be bigoted and disgusting. Anyways, you can tell I have a lot of feelings about this, but that's my preamble, Professor. And feel free to correct me or elaborate either way.
No, I'm with you. I think, you know, admittedly, I think some of the brouhaha is because Ilhan Omar is coming from a subculture,
right,
that doesn't practice the rhetorical nuances of American politics.
Right.
And so, you know, people who grow up in the United States are in politics, are aware, you know, that the Israel lobbies are powerful. And they may have mixed feelings about this in some instances, but they don't think it's illegitimate.
Right.
Because they're also aware that there's lots of ethnic lobbies in the United States. I mean, Nancy Pelosi led a charge to try to get the Turkish government to admit it, the Armenian genocide. Why? Because there's lots of Armenians in her district in San Francisco, and they wanted her to do that. So I think the line you cross is when you say that the Israel lobbies are a manifestation of Jewish power that is somehow illegitimate, or as you say, you know, the hypnotizes, or is somehow out of the mainstream, because it's not.
Right.
It's just how politics are done in the United States. If you have an interest and you don't have a lobby, then you're stupid.
Right.
I think she didn't come up through that system.
Right.
And in her subculture, which focuses on the injustices of the occupation, which is something that Americans don't generally talk about. I mean,
right,
you and I have talked about it here, but let's face it, there is almost never a report on CNN or MSNBC on what's going on in the West Bank.
Right.
Almost never. And so this is just not up for conversation. And so what she's thinking about is, why is this massive injustice being allowed to go on, and why are people attacking her for speaking out on it, and more particularly people who don't seem to have a dog in the fight in ordinary terms. And then she's saying, well, you know, it's because AIPAC is directing organizations to give money to their campaigns. It's all about the Benjamins. And this,
I had no problem with that one.
Yeah,
I think that's
true.
That's true. Right. Sorry.
It's the other side of the coin that there's nothing illegitimate about it either. That's what's objectionable to the attacks on her, is that she's now not being attacked for somehow suggesting that Jewish political interests in the United States are being expressed in a illegitimate way. She didn't say that.
Right.
She's being attacked for simply pointing out the truth, which is that there are Israel lobbies, and they are influential. And if you're going to attack somebody as a racist for saying that, then the word racist just has no longer any meaning.
Well, that's the other amazing thing, is that they're deploying, and you know, again, I always say that some of my critiques of certain misuses of identity politics go back, in fact, to early conversations I had on Israel, where I was like, no, because I share an identity with somebody, I'm not going to support them utterly subjugating another group of people. Sorry. And that's not an argument, let alone a justification for the obscenity of these policies. And so we're in a situation where, of course, this whole conversation is loaded with a huge amount of racism and xenophobia and Islamophobia targeted at her. And then, you know, you have these grotesque spectacles of Steve Scalise, who literally called himself David Duke without the baggage, indirectly implying that she has dual loyalty in terms of getting intelligence briefings, something that she never did in terms of, you know, what people are lying about what she said. And it just, you know, and I'm wondering, though, if the dam is kind of breaking here. I mean, Bernie Sanders had her back in a very clear way. And what's interesting is it seems like everybody's showing the ball, because some people like me are coming forward and saying, hey, look, my politics are such that I want everybody to have full equal democracy, cultural rights, security and protection in that area. And in my view, that's probably some type of secular binational state in my ideology. And then people like Brett Weinstein, who've been smearing and lying about, and in a very bizarre and sick way, Ilhan Omar for a while, are coming out and basically saying, essentially, yes, that criticism of Israel is a form of anti-Semitism, which obviously, in my view, is in fact anti-Semitic, because you're reducing a incredibly persecuted and global population to one nation state, which is inaccurate.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think it's very dangerous for the Jewish communities in the world that this principle of criticizing Israel as anti-Semitic get established, because first of all, we've already discussed about how politics in Israel is horrible.
Right.
if you're not able to discuss it or criticize it without implicating the entire Jewish community, then that is a backdoor form of extreme anti-Semitism. All Jews don't want to be tagged with Netanyahu, and more especially with Kahana.
Right.
There's enormous irony that because of the backlash from the Democratic left, Pelosi is now going to only have a condemnation, a resolution condemning hate speech. But who is a bigger purveyor of hate speech than Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel? So it's a little bit Alice in Wonderland-ish, but I think that Representative Omar, if she manages to keep her seat and go forward, will eventually find ways of navigating the rhetoric that's necessary to deploy to be effective on this issue. And this is the one place I'm a big supporter of hers. I don't want to undermine her, but I do think, if you're talking about political effectiveness, that there are ways of expressing oneself that maybe are more likely to result in actual achievements.
Well, and I agree with you, and I think every indication is that she's obviously incredibly talented and diligent, and she'll, you know, absorb it. And I think also not only strategically, but legitimately. I think she's actually clearly a very empathetic person who's interested and engaged. And I will, you know, I'll say, I didn't think I would contribute money to anybody besides Bernie Sanders, and it wasn't much, but it felt very satisfying to contribute money to her congressional committee. And I hope everybody else will do the same, because she needs, this is a flaring, but I mean, ongoingly, she's going to need an enormous amount of solidarity and support to fight back against all of just the lies and base bigotry that will be targeted at her.
Yeah. Well, the other thing to say, though, is that what she's done is, I think, enormously useful.
Yes.
In the sense that the Nancy Pelosi's think they're progressive and have never done anything at all for the oppressed Palestinians, who are stateless.
Right.
And in some instances under siege, in other instances are actively having their property and their rights stolen from them by armed Israeli squatters on their land. And Pelosi won't admit this, has never admitted it, goes to AIPAC and talks about how the alliance with Israel is essential to being American, which is exactly the kind of thing that Ilhan Omar was complaining about. And the Democratic establishment has to come to terms with the reality of the occupation, which is not going away, which is going to produce more and more crises. And my nightmare is that somehow, the Israeli far right will find a way to destroy the Dome of the Rock and the mosque, the Aqsa Mosque, and I think they have no idea what that's going to produce in the greater Muslim world, because, you know, in Iraq, Peter Galbraith said that the most successful act of terrorism in Iraq killed no one, which was the blowing up of the Samarra Golden Dome, which was sacred to Shiites. And it kicked off in 2006, a massive civil war in Iraq. And people care about these religious symbols in ways that I think secular pundits don't understand. So there are lots of things about the occupation that could produce further conflict and very dire conflict. But that's the one that's foremost in my mind. And so the idea we could, you know, Mitt Romney in 2012 was asked about the Arab-Israeli conflict, and he said, we just have to kick the can down the road. There's nothing that can be done. And that is extremely dangerous.
Professor Juan Cole, he's the author of Muhammad, Prophet of Peace. You got to read Informed Comment if you want to understand what's happening in the broader MENA region, but also other things like sustainable energy. It's an indispensable resource. I learned so much from you. Professor Cole, thank you so much for your time.
It's been great talking to you, Michael.
Thank you. All right, folks, we're going to take a brief break, and then we're going to come back with our second guest, the great Megan Day, Jacobin Magazine. Welcome back to this doubleheader Majority Report. Joining us now is Megan Day. She's a staff writer at the Jacobin Magazine. Her latest pieces are Wielding the Imperial Presidency and Among the Bernie Bros in Brooklyn. Megan, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me again.
So, Megan, I want to start with your piece. I was at the same rally you were in Brooklyn, and as were thousands and thousands of other people. And I want to put just one quote in relationship to your piece, and then I'll throw to you for your impressions of the speeches and the people who were there and so on and the energy of this campaign. There was a piece in Slate where they asked a handful of Bernie supporters about the Bernie Bro moniker. And some of them, I guess, would fit that definition, and they sort of joked about it. There was one woman they talked to, it was a woman of color. They described her as a woman of color, on the somewhere in Upper Manhattan, east or west, who was a nanny, was 35 years old, and she contributed $3 to Bernie's campaign. And she was basically like, yeah, I'm like pretty serious about politics and I kind of need this agenda in my life. And I don't like, I'm sorry, I don't sit on Twitter all day. I don't really know what you're talking about. And I thought that was like, you know, if we could give her voice and millions of other voices, you know, unmediated time, we'd have a much more sane and honest election cycle. And I think your piece did that as well. So what were your impressions of the rally and what did you come away thinking?
The main thing that stood out to me about Bernie's Brooklyn rally is that it was enormously racially diverse for a Bernie rally. I mean, it's something has changed, I think, in the political discourse over the last few years. It's not to say that there wasn't a diverse base of Bernie supporters in 2016. There actually was, especially among younger people, which isn't to say that he didn't struggle with the black vote in the South. But I think that something has changed, actually. I think that people of color in particular are starting to warm up to Bernie Sanders, and young people of color are not just warming up to Bernie Sanders, they're coming out in droves. And that's what I saw at the Brooklyn rally. It's also true that, you know, Brooklyn's a very diverse place. The neighborhood is mostly a POC neighborhood that the rally was held in. And it was held on the Brooklyn College campus, which Bernie attended for a brief time before transferring to the University of Chicago. And many, many Brooklyn College students were there. The article that I wrote, which is called tongue-in-cheek, Among the Brooklyn Bernie Bros, it actually came out, by the way, the same day as a New York Magazine piece sort of profiling the sort of like left literati of Brooklyn. And so you can see the sort of different visions of what left politics
I have
Brooklyn
to say, I,
looks like.
I read that piece and some people will not like my hot take. I thought it was hilarious. And I thought I thought the jabs landed. I'm not going to lie. I mean, it was distorted and it's unfair and unrepresentative, but it was a funny piece.
Yeah, it was pretty colorful, and like those people were obviously present saying those things, so you know.
Yeah, no, they did say those things.
You have to expand.
Right.
You have to expand your view of who actually constitutes, you know, the Brooklyn left.
Right.
And what I found was lots of young people, lots of young women, lots of young people of color, of course, in addition to men and white people, but people of all ages as well. came out, and they came out because they're extraordinarily excited about Bernie Sanders' platform. And this is what everybody that I spoke to was very quick, without my prompting, to pivot to the issues.
Right.
The two issues that came up over and over again were Medicare for All and free college. People also wanted to talk to me about the importance of a $15 minimum wage, a Green New Deal, and serious climate policy. And criminal justice reform, and people sort of, this is a Bernie rally, so these are Bernie supporters, but they sort of uniformly felt that Bernie had the strongest approach to these issues. But Medicare for All and free college tuition seemed to be resonating on a very personal level with a lot of the people that I spoke to, and I'll give you an example. I spoke to two 20-year-old Brooklyn College students. They're both both Muslim women, children of immigrants, come from working class households. They're friends with each other. Their names are Mayar Eliskandrani and Minahil Khan. And Mayar said, you know, she said, you know, when I was making, this is a quote from her, when I was making my college decision, tuition was a really big deal. I got other offers, but it didn't really matter because I knew my family couldn't afford it. This is a gut level reaction. Yeah. To the potential for individual freedom that Bernie Sanders' free tuition proposal actually would make a huge difference in her own life. And then Manal Khan said, I come from a low-income household, and just the other day I had to walk out of a dentist's office. I have insurance, but I couldn't afford the copay, yep. So I just left.
Yep.
And these were their justifications for why. These were the first things that they told me when I asked them why they had come out to support Bernie Sanders. And they also mentioned that it was really important to them to be hearing from a working class child of immigrants who grew up in Brooklyn himself and attended Brooklyn College. And that's something that really stood out about the Brooklyn rally. As you probably read in all of the coverage, Bernie took a turn toward the autobiographical, which is extraordinarily unusual for him, but never one to abandon politics or settle for mere pandering. He polemicized it almost immediately and launched into, I thought, a wonderful portion of the speech where he compared his own working class upbringing to Donald Trump's upper class upbringing. And I think it really resonated with a lot of the people in the crowd across lines of racial difference, of gender difference, of difference in citizenship status or ethnic background and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I was there and that was, I mean, it was hugely effective against Donald Trump. And also, I actually almost teared up when he talked about his background. And those were two things that I also wanted to put on the table. One, I'll take them one at a time. Okay, so one, look, again, there in a broad generality, like who would not love to see a African American woman candidate beat Donald Trump, like just destroy, embarrass, and humiliate him in the electoral college and popular vote? And people's need and desire to have a different representation in the White House is correct and valid and totally legitimate. I don't think it supersedes vital class and policy differences, which is why I support Bernie. And you know, that's just the base of the conversation. And I think we can be respectful, hopefully, and good faith about it on both sides of that equation. And I'm clear where I stand. And I also, but I don't want to delegitimize that sentiment either. That being said, to see a man whose family was directly close relatives killed in the Holocaust, whose family fled Europe in that context, the old white man moniker, I'm actually going to say, is essentially anti-Semitic, disgusting, and I'm not, like, I don't want to hear that. So I just want to put that one across. Yeah.
I'll give you a quote. So, you know, not being myself a person of color, I will give you a quote from a young woman of color that I spoke to at the rally. So right. I asked this young woman, she's 22 years old, she lives in Manhattan, her family comes from Palestine.
Yep.
I asked her if she agreed with the liberal talking point that Bernie is unable to represent people of color because he's a white man, and she responded, "No, no, no, policy over identity."
Right.
And then she continued, "People who say he's just an old white man and it's more of the same are ignoring the importance of his policies for people of color. The people who will benefit the most from Medicare for All, for example, will be working class people of color. When he talks about championing unions and workers' rights, he's talking about the well-being of working class people of color. As someone who's a person of color and an immigrant, not an American citizen, I would vote for him if I could." And then I'll go on and address the gender piece. Being a woman myself, I can say that, you know, it would be enormously satisfying to see a woman in the White House and certainly to see a woman beat Donald Trump. But the fact of the matter is that Bernie Sanders proposes that we tax the wealthiest people in society, who are disproportionately men, to give millions and millions of people who are actually disproportionately women, because women are disproportionately poor, universal health care, universal child care, free college tuition, student debt relief. And he also proposes that the United States guarantee women full reproductive rights, gender pay equity, stronger workplace protections, and unions that they can turn to in the event of harassment and mistreatment, and a living wage. And as a woman, I see my own interests reflected in that platform, and I have a very hard time justifying opposition to Bernie Sanders on feminist grounds for that reason.
Right.
Of course, some people will say, oh, well, you know, Elizabeth Warren likes all of these things too, and she's a woman, so why wouldn't you just prefer Elizabeth Warren? But my answer to that is very simple, which is that in like 2008, Elizabeth Warren was writing white papers about how single payer was actually, you know, a preferable approach to health care for the working class majority. She seemed to understand that that was the case. And yet, for many years after that, she actually declined to champion it.
Right.
She, in 2013, called Medicare for All politically unacceptable. In 2012, I believe, when she ran, she didn't run on it, even though her opponent did. And that's very different from what Bernie Sanders was doing at the exact same time. At the same time, and in fact for decades prior, Bernie Sanders was actually making decisions about the kind of politician that he wanted to be, not based on quote-unquote political acceptability, but actually trying to push the boundaries of what was acceptable by using the office as a bully pulpit for ideas. I mean, he and Warren agreed, but they both agreed that single payer was preferable for the working class majority, and, you know, especially women. But Bernie Sanders was the one who was actually championing it, running on it, and making it ultimately into a mass demand. And so for me, it's pretty obvious that he's the more serious candidate with regards to, I mean, there's going to be enormous pushback on Medicare for All. Who do we trust to actually muscle through this extremely ambitious reform? The person who was cowed into a pose of submission by the idea of political unacceptability, or the person who refused to accept unacceptability and actually push the boundaries of the impossible?
Right, absolutely. And let alone all the other candidates who, you know, have obviously don't even have like the progressive credibility.
Oh, them.
You know, yeah, right, exactly. So there's the difference between Sanders and, I mean, we titled a recent episode of Michael Brooks' show, The Difference Between Sanders and Warren and everybody else, right? Like there's this thing to hash out between two good candidates who have, you know, are absolutely, you know, in the same realm. And then Bernie has major advantages in terms of activism, structure, and commitment. And then, you know, in fact, the other candidates. But that was the other thing too that really came across, was not only was it important and correct and actually moving the way not only he spoke of his biography, but definitely Nina Turner and Sean King, the way they framed it. But it struck me that, you know, with a lot of boomer candidates, it's like, you know, you wheel out, particularly at the convention time or something, like, hey, I'm Bill Clinton and I marched for civil rights. And, you know, I haven't done a goddamn thing for 40 years, but I was there. And the thing that was so interesting about this was this a candidate who's so hesitant about exploiting his biography in that way, you realized, like, not only is it not sort of biographical anecdote, this really is just a through line. I mean, this is the same person that got arrested protesting housing segregation in Chicago, is the same person who ran improbable campaigns to become mayor of Burlington and protect the public park and empower small businesses, was actually a nationally recognized effective mayor, and then toiled in the House and the Senate for Medicare for All and voted against welfare reform and opposed the Iraq invasion and talked about wealth concentration when everybody was deregulating Wall Street. This is the same. And even in 2019, the last thing I'll put on this, he is a better candidate in 2016, both as a communicator and he's more to the left. And what's so interesting is that not in all areas, but the areas in which he's been pushed, like he talked about gentrification. He said the word military industrial complex. He's like, okay, I will get better on race and racism. So I'm going to talk about gentrification. I'm not going to, like, you know, do the nay nay. I'm going to talk about this actual stuff and incorporate it into this broader agenda. And again, there's more to do. It's not perfect, but these are significant strides. And the same person that was that youthful protester.
Right. I actually think that Bernie Sanders is not content with pandering. He finds it to be reprehensible. And actually, in some cases, it's held him back because he doesn't realize, or he hasn't necessarily realized in the past that there's a degree of communication about the importance of these issues that he might be lacking, hoping that the policy ideas will speak for themselves. I think he's gotten a lot better on that front. And after Brooklyn, he spoke in Chicago, and he did an excellent job, not just paying lip service to racial justice, but actually presenting a coherent political worldview about the conditions under which racism is actually manifests and shapes people's lives, their life outcomes, you know, degrades their living conditions, and what a politician can do to change it. But I also want to add to that that the main theme that I'm seeing coming through after going to the Brooklyn rally and after going to the Chicago rally is not the autobiography, and it's not the specific focus on racial justice. It's actually a broader focus on the importance of movements to his own potential presidency. And I actually think this is really important, and I'm going to tell you why. It's that Bernie Sanders is somewhat of an accident of history. So I'm a socialist. I'm an organized socialist. I'm a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. I'm a writer for a socialist magazine. And I can tell you with great certainty that socialists, while Bernie Sanders' 2016 run was a massive boon to the socialist movement, we would not have designed it this way if we could do it on paper. What we would have designed instead was the growth of the labor movement, strong unions, the growth possibly of a party, or at least a party-like formation that was capable of running and disciplining candidates from within its own ranks, and the growth of left social movements throughout the country in all sectors that would be able to support a presidential candidate. And we would have that candidate rise up from that organic left groundswell. But that's not what happened. What actually happened was that Bernie Sanders had, is like a time traveler from the last time that class politics was on anybody's lips in the United States, and he kind of went underground a little bit. He had this sort of like 4-decade-long wilderness period.
Well, it's
which
these Obi-Wan Kenobi people. It's like him and Corbin.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
we're extraordinarily lucky that he did not compromise on his principles like so many people who came out of the new left did, and he stayed really, really consistent. And we're also really lucky that he's still alive and still has the energy to be, you know, a leader, and that he has the will to do that. So there's some subjective qualities here.
Yep.
And that it happened to line up with the objective material conditions. You know, the financial crisis happened in 2008, Occupy happened in 2011, and the mood of the nation changed, and Bernie Sanders happened to still be alive, still be consistent, still be principled, still be a democratic socialist, and he's built up the record to actually justify him taking a leadership position in the American political sphere. So the reason I'm saying all of this is because if he becomes president, he is going to, we don't have that organic, robust left infrastructure populating the space between dog catcher and president,
right?
Either in the electoral sphere or in the non-electoral sphere. We still are very happy that Bernie Sanders could become president for a variety of good reasons, but it does pose some tricky problems. He's going to face a hostile Congress. He's not going to have a ton of sympathizers in the state. He might not even have people, might not be a robust political education outside of the state to make sense of the pushback that he's going to get to his agenda. So the only way to actually get around this problem is to build mass extra parliamentary left social movements that can create crises outside of the state in the form of protests, in the form of strikes, in the form of pressure campaigns, in the form of media attention, in order to pressure lawmakers to respond to those crises, solve them, and therefore that go along with Bernie Sanders' agenda, even though they don't want to, even though they're beholden to their donors and so on and so forth. So I think he understands that, the importance of extra parliamentary movements. And you saw that at the Chicago rally in particular, where he brought up an 18-year-old Black Lives Matter activist as the first speaker at that rally. He brought up an anti-gentrification activist who was also a young woman of color. And then he spent the bulk of his racial justice speech talking about his political history outside the state. That's what's really important. When he talks about his political history now, he's not just talking about his record as a mayor, as a congressman, as a senator. He's talking about his political record when he was just like you in the crowd, when he was just an ordinary person who wanted to make change in the world and who put, you know, his body on the line and who devoted his time and his energy to actually participating in movements to make that change.
And that's in the final couple of minutes. I mean, that's how you talk about him wielding the presidency, is to actually, and he's really nailing. I mean, another thing that I noticed in the Brooklyn speech was he reformulated that Obama, not red states, not blue states, but instead of a kind of like mushy call for sort of like shared civility, he was like, recognize that you're all workers. And
yes.
that's how, right? And so that's the relation.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I have an analysis of that, which is that Obama was trying to unify and not polarize. Like, that was his strategy, was like, we're all in this together, but he was unable to identify protagonists and antagonists. But Bernie Sanders wants to unify literally by polarizing along new lines, which are class lines. He knows that we can unite the vast majority of the American people against the billionaire class, because most people in America are not billionaires. So it's actually a completely different strategy than Obama's, even though it has some of the same features, the not red state, not blue state, you know, uniting across lines of difference. Obama was just uniting across lines of difference, period. That would be good. Bernie Sanders is unite across lines of difference against the people that we are all most different from, who are the billionaires who are controlling the levers of society.
And as a final thought, I mean, this is, and that's where, like, not only, and of course, like, he is, in many respects, he's the front runner. He has the most organic support. He's the most significant candidate, as of, you know, he has the credibility, you know, of the successful previous run. And then, unlike being a front runner, obviously, there's just this, I mean, there's the sort of natural, like, I understand, again, sometimes there's valid criticisms of him. Those valid criticisms come from the left of him, so usually, so they're not even electorally represented. And then there's even just like, hey, look, I'm a centrist or I'm part of a different political machine. Okay, you're not going to support Bernie Sanders, but there's also a huge amount of just irrationality and weirdness in the dislike of him. So there's that sort of, you know, yeah, look at what a, yeah, this nice old Jewish guy wants to give you healthcare. What an asshole, you know, that just sort of bizarre dislike of him that comes across in mainstream media circles. But so that's the dialectic. And ultimately, he will win even as the front runner, as a grassroots door-to-door candidate. And even more importantly, that's actually how he'll govern. And the only chance we have of both his agenda and also the broader social and class conflict we need to have if we're going to get our way out of the climate, the inequality, you know, any of these predicaments, the predicaments of capitalism.
It's kind of lucky for us in a way, even though this is an accident of history and it's not how socialists would have planned it on paper, it's kind of lucky for us that he'll be in this predicament in the White House of not having any friends in the state, because it will actually force him to get any of his agenda passed. It will actually force him to use the office very differently. He will have to use it as, he'll have to be a tribune for class politics from the position of the presidency, building movements outside of the state in order to get anything passed, just on a sheer strategy level, which is fantastic in a way,
yep.
Right? Because it reduces the possibility that he's going to capitulate to the structural pressures of the presidency. Because if he wants to pass Medicare for All, he's sure as hell going to have to get people out on the streets flooding, you know, having town halls, flooding, you know, politicians' offices, holding mass protests in order to get it done. If he can't do that, then it's not going to happen. So it's going to turn him, I think, into a very effective grassroots movement builder just by the nature of the dynamics.
Megan Day, I agree with you completely, and people should read all of Megan Day's just indispensable work at Jacobin. Really, everywhere you're coming from.
Thanks so much.
Honestly, because I send it to people too who are, you know, like in the baby boomer cohort, people of different, you know, or actually the worst Gen Xers, people at different and you're the type of writer that people can be like, okay, I at least I get this more now, across the board. So I really, really appreciate your work, and thanks so much for taking the time, Megan Day.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Take care. All right, folks, that was a good doubleheader. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Less than a cup of coffee today, a day, to support robust, unbought, unbossed, independent media with, you know, I mean, look at all of the terrain we've covered, from Tim Apple to socialism. How to a Bernie's presidency would work, to the real nature of Israel, to freeing Lula and restoring Brazilian democracy. And that's just on the first half of the show. We're going to see you in the fun half. Of course, I cover a lot of similar things, but very in-depth coverage of international relations, philosophy, all sorts of other areas on the Michael Brooks Show. I would become a patron of it today, patreon.com/TMBS. This weekend, an illicit history of Caribbean debt and imperial colonial relationships with Tamanisha John, PhD candidate at Florida International University. This past Sunday, Ben Burgess joined us to talk about logic for the left and who is really suppressing free speech. Our YouTube channel is flying. Get a ton of clips there where you can get a sense of it. Go to Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Subscribe there. And of course, patreon.com/TMBS. Jamie, what's cooking with the anti-mother effing fada? I thought of that guy who complained about his kid hearing too much swears. Sorry.
Yeah, you gotta protect the children. MR is for the children.
Shade.
So,
yeah. For the children, you should swear more so they can learn.
I mean, that's what I said.
So they can learn how to be cool for school.
That's what I said. But, you know, I'm not the boss of this show. So if you want to hear me swear, you can listen to the Antifada. This week, we kind of effed up the sound, but you could still hear us. They say you're not a real podcaster until you've lost a whole episode. We had on Hamilton Nolan of Splinter News to talk about labor organizing in the media and beyond. Is millennial entitlement good for labor organizing? I don't know. What else do we talk about? I don't know.
Millennial entitlement. Like the intern generation.
Yeah,
the
so
effing entitled to people who's like, hey, is it possible? Oh, of course, don't worry about healthcare. But do you think maybe I get a Subway voucher for doing like free unpaid labor for your multinational? Super entitled
people. So entitled. Yeah.
Yes.
Hamilton and I also squash an ancient beef that we had. And he talks about his successful labor organizing drive at Gawker right before it was, you know, everything.
Oh, good drive.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Yeah. Right before, you know, who came in and messed with everyone's world. I talk about my own successful labor organizing drive at the place I used to work. Check it out, folks. Patreon.com/TheAntifada or any podcast app.
Matt.
Yeah. Wakefield by Nathaniel Hawthorne, a short story. We do the whole thing. Check that out. Also for YouTube, The Unparalleled Adventures of One Hans Fall is finally up there in all of its 3 hours and 20 minutes.
All right, folks. We'll see you on the fun half.
And I told them to stop it, knock it off. It needs to be simple. Keep it simple. Infrastructure, no bumps in the road. Socialism here in America. ~52% of American millennials would like to live in a socialist or communist America. Yes, indeed, boo. Yes, indeed, hiss.
And maybe we need a solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
I think the day I talked to Sam was like the worst day of my life.
You're a bunch of disingenuous bastards.
What do you think about that? Do you even care?
Ask the moms.
And they ended up finding themselves in this whole irony, and but you know, right, it was just kind of amusing.
Please don't try to talk over me, which is what liberals do.
Why do you hate that we're here right now talking about stuff?